Hi, this is Jackie.
And this is Tanner.
And you're listening to the Finding Love in the Chaos of Life podcast.
This podcast dives into stories, both yours and ours, on finding peace and non-resistance with life's challenges and chaos.
Let us inspire and support each other on our journey towards inner peace as we open our stories to the perspective of love.
Let's dive in.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Finding Love in the Chaos of Life. We're very excited today, Tanner and I, as we have a guest again, and this is George Taylor. I'll tell you a little bit more about George in a minute. But George, how are you doing today?
Very well. Good to see you again, Jackie. Thanks for having me on.
And Tanner, how are you doing today?
So well, thanks. So lovely to meet you, George. Have you on?
Nice to meet you too.
Yeah, very exciting. So our audience probably doesn't know, I actually met George 2 years ago when he invited me onto his platform, Gramercy, for an interview. And that was around my book, Life's Not Yoga. And we delved into the topic of suicide ideation and overcoming. So that was a big one for us. And if that's a topic that interests any of you, then do go to Gramercy's YouTube channel or my YouTube channel, Jackie Burnett, and check out that interview and that conversation about overcoming. But today we're going to listen to George's story. He's going to share a finding love and should we say some success in terms of overcoming something that he took on recently. So George Taylor is a media publishing and event expert with almost 10 years under his belt and 2 successful organizations. George has spoken at Google and Social Media Week on behalf of Eventbrite and is it the General Assembly? There we go. That's impressive, George. Wow, wow, wow.
Thank you.
George is the founder and CEO of Gramercy, as I mentioned to you earlier, and it's a digital publisher specializing in consumer and retail startup news, content, insight, and events. He previously founded Creative Industry Hub, the media and event company for music, fashion, and influencer sectors that has thousands of customers and millions of readers. George has worked with the likes of House of Fraser, Sony Music, Tropic Skincare, Cian Marie, I hope I pronounced that right, Taylor, Lady Windsor Amelie, M plus LK, it's a double plus there for me, okay, M plus LK plus, and many more during his career. But the exciting thing that we're going to be talking about is about George is also a guitarist and a songwriter at Good Time Locomotive. And George, I have to say, I did check it out on YouTube and I love it. I absolutely love it. Well done.
Thank you so much, Jackie. I'm glad, really glad you like it. The song's had such a great reception so far. And obviously, as I'm just about to tell you guys, anyone that's listening in, it's been a long and winding bendy road to get this song out, but to get to the finishing line, to have the response be so great, it does make all the pain worth it. And I think really that's going to be my underlying message today, is that sometimes you can feel like you're never going to get there and that there's all these things going wrong and you want to give up and you're not sure if the pain is going to be worth it the other side. And sometimes it isn't, I'll be honest with you, but I think that's a risk you have to take. But in this instance, it's totally worth the pain. And obviously, I'll talk a little bit more about how this whole thing came about shortly. So, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. And, you know, when we originally spoke, you spoke about, you know, the disillusionment along the way that comes up. And I often think in that sometimes we doubt whether we're ever going to get there. And that's painful. It's hard to deal with because it's, you know, it's endless. I know with my book, you know, I always say it took me 53 years to write it, but when I actually committed, it was, you know, a good 10 years before from when I really started, you know, drawing up the first manuscript to finally getting it published. So I really do understand that. And Tanner, as we know, you're a little bit young, but you're also going to tell stories of how of decades of challenge down the line. Yeah, George is younger than us. Exactly. But it's not that you don't have those. But George, why don't you tell us your story, and then Tanner and I will be sure to be asking you some questions or share our opinions on some of the processes that you might have gone through that you might not be aware of in terms of reaching a stage of what we would call enlightenment about actually getting this song out into the world.
Sure. I mean, it's a long story that's going back over, literally 20 years, 21 years. So I'm going to condense it down and obviously I have to miss a lot of stuff out. But music was my first love. And that's kind of why I wanted to come on this podcast, really, because obviously the podcast is called Finding Love, you know, in the Chaos, right? And I feel like that's what music has always been to me. And I know I'm not the only one. I know plenty of people that listen to music feel the same way. So it was the first thing that made sense to me. I mean, until the age of 13, 14, I didn't really have a passion or a thing, you know, a thing that I felt drawn to. And when I kind of started getting into rock music and maybe when I was 12, 13 years old, I just felt this automatic instant affinity and synergy to this new sound that I'd never previously been exposed to. And I just got addicted to it. And I was like, what is this? I don't, it's kind of confusing. It's new, it's fresh. I don't fully understand what it is I'm listening to, but I just had this curiosity and I begged my mum to, you know, get me a guitar. That's what she did. She got me a guitar. But actually, there's a funny little story there. I remember walking into the music block at school, and my music teacher used to hate me because I was always bunking off the school lessons. I was always being naughty, you know, throwing Coke cans around the room and doing all the usual things that you do when you're like 12 years old.
In other words, you were spirited.
Yeah, exactly. I was always a fiery and feisty one in the music room. And to be honest, I had absolutely no interest in music at the age of 11. I just didn't care. You know, and I guess that's one thing I regret a little bit, because I should have listened to what the woman had to say, because obviously that information would have been more important later in life. But anyway, I went in there one day with my towel between my legs, you know, the walk of shame. And I kind of, excuse me, you know, knock on the secretary door, and she comes out like, what are you doing here? Like just slowly like, sorry, why are you here? Like, of all people in the world, what are you doing here? And I said, I just looked at her, and I actually felt embarrassed to ask her, because I didn't feel like I deserved it, really. I felt like I'd been such a joke in school. And I said, Mrs. Shepherd, and I kind of stuttered a few times, and I was like, I want to learn guitar. I want to do music lessons for my GCSE. And she just went and just laughed right in my face. She laughed and she's like, you are having a laugh, aren't you? I was like, I'm actually not. No, I think you're winding me up. Come on. And I was like, no, really, really. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, she's like, let me think about it. So I come back a week later and she's like, all right, I've had a think about it. I'm going to give you one chance. Wow. And if you blow it, I'll have absolutely no problem booting you the hell out of it. That's what she said to me. She said, so you best get your head down. Sure. I'm not messing around. You've already used all your nine cat lies on me. You've got one more, and that's it. So I realized there and then I had this one chance I had this opportunity that had been granted to me that wasn't a given, and I had to really make the most of that. And so anyway, actually, here's the funny thing. She arranged for me to get guitar lessons, and I went into the room, and when I got in there, I just couldn't do it. It was just like, this guitar thing just didn't make any sense to me at all. Mm. I was like, how am I going to learn this? This is just insanely overwhelming, you know? So I dropped off. Like, as in, I went back to my teacher and I said, Mrs. Shepherd, I'm so sorry, I just can't do it. And she looked at me and she went, told you. She knew it. No. She was like,
heart
I knew.
Breaks.
Yeah, she was like, I knew you wouldn't do it. Sorry to say it, George, but I knew you wouldn't do it. She was right. Anyway, a few weeks later, I was in the music block again for whatever reason, and there was this bass guitar sitting there on the wall, and I'd never seen one before. I didn't know. And I was like, what is this? I picked it up. And as soon as I picked it up, it just clicked. The penny just dropped.
Like you were home.
Yeah. I had this moment there. And I went back in there and I said, Mrs. Shepherd.
My goodness, you did not.
I did. I said, I know you're going to kill me. I know you're going to absolutely kill me, but please. I said, I think I've got it. She's like, all right, go on then. We do need a bass player in the school, so go on then. And then anyway, so the guitar teacher that I had left also taught bass. And I went in there and he took me on his wing. And that was it. That was a start right there. And the bass just made sense to me. But the funny thing is, I played bass for about 3 years. I excelled and got really good at it. In quite a short space of time, but I never really wanted to be a bass player. I always wanted to be a guitar player, and I guess that was always my itch to scratch. So a few years later, my good friend Jamie and his stepdad John gave me his old guitar. And then, but what was weird is that because I'd learned the basics on the bass, suddenly the guitar now made more sense to me. So I had almost a foundation to start building on. So, and that's really where it started. And I for the first few years, I just put my head down. I was playing 4 or 5 hours a day, every day. If the teacher gave me a book and said, learn this, I'd learn it. I was just absolutely determined. And I used a ruthless, almost militant kind of approach to getting the job done. And I got really, really good by the time I was maybe 18, 19. I'd started to, you know, write my own songs. I'd bought a little cheap recording studio in my bedroom. And then I started to produce those first batch of songs. But I think the thing is that I mean, prior to me being involved in this band that I'm doing now, Good Time Locomotive, I had two or three, I would say, you know, moderately successful music projects. They were, when I say successful, I don't mean like we were number one on the chart success. But for what they were, for a little kid that, you know, didn't really have a two pennies to scrape together, who knew, I'd managed to build myself quite a big platform on multiple occasions. So I seemed to have a bit of a knack for the game. One of my songs had, you know, over 1 million views on MySpace at the time. I played music festivals. I'd been in on the radio. I had a few kind of successes. But then the problem with music is it can all go so wrong, you know? It can all go so wrong. And when it's a little bit like a breakup, you know, like you feel so in love with somebody and then they don't want you anymore. And that's it. And you're left with the grief after. And two or three of those music projects that I did in my late teens, early 20s, all were kind of met the same demise. There came this point where I felt like I just don't want to do this anymore because I associated music with pain. And whereas prior to that, I'd always associated music with love and it become a painful thing. So I put the guitar in the cupboard. I didn't take it back out again. And I was done. I was over with it. I was like, no, no more. But there's this big hole to fill in my life. So I decided that I needed to find a new passion that then became business. My first business that I launched when I was 25 was, as you just said earlier on, Jackie, was Creative Industry Hub, specializing in like big music networking events, big fashion network events. And I ran out for 5 years. It was, you know, reasonably successful. And we had all sorts of people coming through the door, record labels, famous artists, session players, managers. Wow. And I just loved it. But I always felt this, I started to get this feeling of I'm helping all these music people get where they want to be, all of them. And I used to have people writing in, oh, thanks, I've got a job at whatever now. Oh, cheers, thanks for helping me out. I'm now in this band with this person. And I sort of felt like I'd left myself out of the equation. You know, I'd helped hundreds and hundreds, of, maybe even thousands of people to achieve their music dreams, but I hadn't helped myself. So, and time was ticking on. I was getting a bit older. I was like, should I do this again? Kind of thing. So it was a big decision. And to be honest with you, I still wasn't at the point where I wanted to do it. I mean, come 27, 28 years old, I was like, nah, I just can't do this again. You know, I just don't feel like I'm ready for this. I was still traumatized from the last experience. So anyway, a good friend of mine, James, who's a long running drum teacher, you know, quite a well-known guy in the local community and local music community. Outstanding drum player, absolutely outstanding. Just kept, you know, ringing me. He's like, George, we need to do some songs. And, you know, we'd previously tried a few bits and it hadn't really worked out. And I just was like, nah, sorry. It asked me again a month later, nah, sorry. And keep asking me. Anyway, he just pursued me until in the end, I finally just caved. And I was like, I finally caved. And I said, all right, I'm gonna give it a go. And he's like, all right, good. So he was obviously well happy because he obviously was headhunting me and trying to get me in on this project. So he started off with two men in a boat because James lives on a barge. You know, after his divorce, he sold the house and bought a barge because As we do. He wanted to opt in for the, you know, the minimalist, the hippie, the countryside life. And so our first date, if you like, our first musical date was on a boat. And he has a recording studio in there, and it was very, I'll talk a little bit about this now actually, because it was a weird experience when you're walking in a new room with a guitar that you haven't played in maybe 5 years. You've got very little ideas. you can't really play very well anymore. You sort of got out to play the thing. And you're older, your life has changed. How the heck are you supposed to write songs under that situation? Mm-hmm. So I found that really hard because I'd pick up the guitar, nothing would happen, or I'd write something and it'd just be garbage. I was like, I think I've lost it. And I'm trying. Nothing's decent is coming out. And there comes this point where you get maybe 6 months into it, you've written and recorded 30, 40 songs, and all of it is just utter rubbish. A lot of it. There's like not one riff in there that's like, this is a winner. Everything just sucked badly. And James said to me, we had this chat. He sat on the staircase leading up to the front of the boat. And he's like, bro, I've been doing this with you for nearly a year now. He said, I'm really sorry, but I just don't feel like it's working out. He said, obviously, you know, I'm a fan of your music. And obviously it was me that hired you. It was me that sort of wanted to get you on board because I love your stuff. He said, but you know, we haven't produced anything that's worthwhile. And we've spent 10 months, 11 months doing this. I'm at the point where I'm not sure how much longer I'm going to have for this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He's like, really sorry, but this is basically the ultimatum chat. That's what this is. If we don't come up with a song, I'm walking away. I then got scared because I realized that a year of my life was going to be down the drain, and I was going to walk away and have nothing to show for my time, and I would have missed this great opportunity to do music one more time. So I guess I felt this sense of pressure me to perform. Anyway, weird story. We walked into the room shortly after that chat, maybe 5-10 minutes after that chat, plugged the guitar in, booted up the keyboard, and that's Lines of Symmetry happened, the song that you've heard, Jackie.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how. I don't know why. I don't know how. I don't know what it was. I can't tell you. Maybe it was that chat. I don't know. Like, I'll never fully understand it, but we just wrote this tune and it was just like, this is it. You know, and that was really where it started there. It started there. But I remember saying to James at the time, I said, we have to, this is the bar. We've now set this bar of standard that we now want to adhere to moving forward. And we made sure that everything we did, we strove for that quality. We strove for that quality. And it just started to work after that. So we did start to just produce, if you don't mind me saying, hit after hit after hit after hit. And we ended up writing an album together of every songs I'm immensely proud of. But the thing is that was only such a small part of it. Like, you would think that having 12 or 14 songs that are, you know, winners would be the tough bit out of the way. I was so wrong about that. I really was. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing is I compared it to my old music projects where when you're 19, 20, excuse me, do you want to play in a band? Yeah, sure. All right, cool. Here's a song. Learn, do it, get up on stage, off you go. Like that's how it is when you're a kid, right? But obviously when you get older, you're in your 30s, people's, have got, you know, jobs, they've got children, houses, bills, other things to sort to do. People can't be quite like that because of obviously the change, how different your life is when you're in your 30s to when you're in, say, your late teens, right? So we had all these obstacles we had to go up against, and that was really where I'd say the challenge started, the long and winding road. The first thing was we got these songs together and we needed to find a singer. But that's the first thing we need to do. But I just underestimated how hard that would be. I think I thought you'd put an ad on Facebook or something, or on one of the music forums, and you'd get just inundated with these super genius singers. I was so wrong about that. I mean, we must have gone through 500 singers in terms of people sending us their demo tapes, their auditions, their videos. And you were listening to these, and I'm not joking, you know, within 5 seconds, they're not the right person. You're like, nope, next one. And we're just waiting for something. We're waiting for something special to come along. I use a bunch of different websites like Star Now, which is quite a famous casting website. It's got kind of global presence. I think I posted that ad 15, 16 times. But anyway, eventually this guy called Hugo from Portugal, Portuguese chap, young gentleman, was much younger than us, fresh-faced, came in. I was like, I'm interested. And I was like, all right, you know, but by this point, I'm like, oh, it's just going to be another rubbish singer. It's going to be another guy that can't sing. And he sends me this song, And I was like, I was sort of on the fence about it. I was like, you know what? I see what James thinks. So I gave it to James. James was like, I like this guy. I was like, I don't. By the way, if he's listening, he knows this. It's told him this. He shouldn't get offended by it. I wasn't convinced, to be honest with you, and I told him that a few times. He knows that. But so anyway, James was like, can we just give this guy a shot, please? I was like, all right. So we gave him Lines of Symmetry, the backing track with no vocals in it, and said, write something to this. And he sent it back. And it was like, I'm not sure this is the guy. James is like, please, I hear something in this guy. Please, please give him a second chance. I was like, I felt like I was extending myself too far than I normally would. But anyway, I did.
I'm
so glad that I did.
I think that was when you were being Mrs. Shepherd.
Yes.
Giving him a second chance.
Definitely. I think I was. And he came back and he blew my brains out that second time. And I went, whoa. And he just knocked me for six. And I was like, that's the guy. That is the guy. And it was just, boom. It was magic. It was. And he was such a timid chap when we first met him. He was young, just moved to London from Portugal. English wasn't amazing. Had never really been a proper band before. Had never really worked with, you know, older, more slightly more experienced guys. And then, so he was in a difficult position. He really was. And his voice was nowhere near as established as it is now. Nowhere near as what it is these days. And then COVID-19 happened. He joined the lineup in March 2020, 3 or 4 days before we went into lockdown. 3 or 4 days.
Sure.
Crazy. And he was put on furlough at work. And I said, bro, knock yourself out. There's 14 songs there. And he did. He wrote.
Wow.
I know. Within 3 months, he had not, well, actually two months. He'd whacked through these tunes at a crazy speed. I have never been so, blown away and impressed by someone's talent before. Like, is it on a working relationship level? I've never worked with anyone that's just had what he has. He's got a special, very special thing going for him. He's a unique singer. He's a distinct, you know, he writes songs that get stuck in your head for days. His vocal ability is just top notch. So then
he's got a gift.
He has got that gift. And I know that everyone agrees. Everyone that meets him, watches him, listens to him agrees he's got that gift. So, but we had to coach him for 2 years to get to that point. Like, he didn't start off like that. He was like a rough diamond, you know? And we've just pushed him. We've misshepherded him a little bit along the way.
Good.
And then he just broke
through.
We love
Mrs. Shepherd.
Love Mrs. Shepherd. We've misshepherdized him a little bit along the way, and he's fully come into himself and his own. He's become a guy that's good enough by himself now, which I've told him that a few times. So then we became a trio. But then again, you think, oh, this is it. We're getting somewhere. No, we're not. There's more. There's more of the journey to come. And the next thing was finding band members, which became, I mean, I thought finding a singer was hard. Really, I did. I really thought that was going to be the difficult appointment out of the way. No, I was wrong. Finding pianists and bassists is 20 times harder.
Wow.
It really is. We had hundreds and hundreds of conversations. We'd get a guy, he'd come in, learn the songs and quit. We'll have to start again. And we did this 7 times with a bass player and 5 times with a keyboard player.
Mm.
That's just the people that we actually pushed through out of the hundreds that we listened to, right? Because most of them didn't have the technical capability, or they didn't get on with the band, or you know, we didn't gel from either side. Mm-hmm. So it just was really hard. Like, it was a really difficult thing, and it got to like, well over a year later, and we're like, are we ever going to find anybody? It's just getting it started to get ridiculous. It was like, how have we gone through 6 bass players? What? Is anyone going to ever stay? We had booked shows. We'd rehearsed the songs. We had booked music venues to play at. We'd had the banners designed. The guy would leave. We'd have to start again. Just round and round you go, and we did this multiple times. We had to cancel rehearsal space that we booked. it just started to get to that real difficult point where it was almost starting to wonder whether we should stop, because it was getting to that sort of red zone territory. I don't know why I kept going. I don't know what kept me going. I genuinely think it was just stubbornness, to be honest with you, but refusal to let these people beat me and stop me in my tracks. So we kept looking, and then the third show we cancelled was actually a venue called The Horns in Watford. James knew the lady, I think, who owned it or was the promoter there or something. And anyway, we had to cancel it three times. And I said to James, there's no way this lady's going to book us for a fourth time. She's going to think we're like kids. We're like messing around. Mm. He's like, look, I can do it. There came the day where the venue was booked for the fourth time.
Mm.
And I got to be honest with you, I didn't believe it happened. I was like, until I'm standing on stage playing the song with the band, I don't believe it's going to happen, because I just didn't believe it was going to happen. But then there came the day where we turned up there, and everyone turned up, and the gear was set up and the drum kit was set up, and we had 100 people in that first show in the audience. That was like the best feeling ever in the world. It was a remarkable feeling. I'll never forget it. It was like a 12-year music hiatus coming to an end, a second chance at life. More like a fourth chance. Finally putting to rest this 5-year-long project that had just dragged on and on and on and on. We didn't think it was going to happen. But we put so much heart and soul into these songs that to play them was like, it was just an unbelievable feeling. It was a feeling I could never explain in words. I just lost myself in the music.
See it all over your face. It was a beautiful day.
Mm. It was a beautiful day. And then anyway, we then had to get the songs out, and you know, that went around the same thing of album artworks not working out, fire the graphic designer. But this producer sent back a bad mix, fire that guy, round and round and round and round and round and round and round you go. And you've heard the mix. You've heard 30 different mixes of it of the song. You're sick of hearing it. You're like, I can't even list this song anymore because I'm so sick of hearing it. That happens. And then finally it goes out on YouTube on my birthday, my 35th birthday, and Spotify and Apple Music on Saturday, the 13th of May, and waking up in the morning and just not believing it's real. Not believing that this has really happened. Wow. Like it didn't feel like it was going to happen. And also the success of the song. I mean, we've had like 14,000 views of the video so far in just over a week. And I mean, I know it's not like a billion views, but for a small startup band that's kind of spent, you know, very little money on advertising, has got basically no profile whatsoever, the song seems to have kind of taken off in that regard. And it's just an amazing feeling to be doing something that I guess is a lifelong passion of mine, that I had forgotten what it feels like to do it because it'd been so long. And to now have that out and to go, we've now got singles and videos being released, you know, every month now, come back to back, coming out, everything's scheduled, everything's good to go. And yeah, I never thought I'd ever do it ever again. I never thought I would ever do this ever again, because obviously I retired from music. So it's been a fantastic experience, and I'm glad I hung in there for all the hell really to get where we are. Yeah. So that's my story.
That's fantastic. You know, and George, what comes up for me in terms of the Dare to Be Loved journey, as we talk about it, in terms of the processes that you went through, in terms of taking on change to getting to conversation number 10, which, you know, I refer to in the Dare to Be Loved journey as life's purpose. And when you spoke about that 12-year-old, that you said something like, it's the first thing that made sense to me. That is when we are actually hearing the voice from spirit. It's our own spirit that's connecting with universal spirit about something that is vitally important to be done. And it's always something vitally important that is creative and beautiful. And when I listen to your story, and you know, you could maybe go on the website and look at the Dare to Be Loved journey, because the conversations that you went through internally that I can pick up is the aspect of looking at your belief systems, your thoughts, your behaviors, and your words. And the conversations that you were going through was change, suffering. At times you had to forgive yourself for wanting a different experience. Like, this is the fifth bass player. Why did I have to go through the other four? And then you just lean in again. And you spoke about some of the pain that you went through and then surrendering to acceptance. And that's when I talk about where you go to truth and you started then acting from a space of true will. I will just keep pitching up because music is, you know, brings me such joy. And the final step is that the final three steps are, you know, is where your intrinsic values, I am worthy of creating this. And I want to go back to that day after 10 months. And this is where it's going to be quite interesting, because in that moment, I believe, when you were on the barge, I think, and you said that this was, you know, he said you've got to stop because it made no more sense. And it's almost when you completely surrendered, because there was nothing to lose, and you accepted that aspect of surrendering, is that that aspect of all I have is the energy within me to produce, nothing else. And because you spoke earlier about some of the fears, you didn't know how, but in that moment of possibly giving it up, you just surrendered, fear goes away and everything. And that's when the spirit, that essence of energy can come through you. And that's what happens for me as a writer, is when I trust, I don't have to suffer to be creative, you know, because you spoke about the aspect of artists, you know, all the suffering that can happen. And that song came out, which then becomes the very vehicle that keeps the momentum going, is knowing that it's within, and you keep trusting that voice that, you know, brings this incredible stuff from nowhere. You're taking it out of the ether and you're creating music, you're using words. And so that was very special for me, you know, listening to that. And also you spoke about when you gave it up in your 20s, is music had always been a love for you and it became pain. And when we work from the aspect of pain or fear, and I think you can maybe pick up the two things, when you were in pain, and then 10 months later, when you were trying to force the music, it triggers the old pain story, and then the ego gets hooked because you're not doing it for the aspect of when you said when music was just love. And I think in that moment of surrendering on that barge where this is just it, this is all I have to give, this is what comes from within me and through me. And I think that's absolutely beautiful, because you said you kept trying and nothing decent was coming up. It was when you stopped trying.
I think you're right, Jackie. And that's why that song's so special to me, because that song is the song. It's exactly what you just said there. That's the first song that was finished. It's the first song that's been out. It's the first song that people have heard. That song is really the baseline. It's the foundation of everything within music for me. It's my comeback song. So you only ever get that once. But maybe you are right. And I think the problem is because I hadn't written for so long, I did forget how to do it. And there was a sense of maybe trying too hard with that. Yeah. And it was, and like you say, because I've often attributed the fact that we had that conversation that led to the Lines of Symmetry single. Attributed to that. I have wondered whether that did play a part in that song suddenly coming out of nowhere. You know, why then? Why not a month before? Maybe that chat had something to do it. So I agree with you there. But it also seemed to unlock the creativity moving forward. It's like I'd had a door locked, and something about that particular day unlocked the door, and then everything we wrote off that kind of did to that sort of standard. To kind of go into a bit more detail about that, with what you said about like the ego and the fears and the self-doubts and all that stuff, when you're young, you don't have that. When you're 17,
not as bruised.
you just pick it up and you just play it. That's what you do. You don't think about it. You don't doubt yourself, question it, ask why. Should I do it like this? Should I do it like that? Or what about this approach? You just do it. Or at least I did. I just picked the thing up and played it. I never thought why, never asked myself a question, never, you know, sub-rationalize it to myself. And I think that is the art of great creativity. It's the art of being almost naive and empty and clear-minded and just letting the music just go through you. You know, I used to teach guitar, you know, many years ago, like kind of privately, and I always used to tell my students that music's in your head. The guitar, music's not the guitar, it's not the piano. That is an extension, it's an accessory of what's in here. And 90% of my songs start in my brain before I even get the guitar in my hand. What does that really tell you about musical instruments? What it really tells you is that really they're just vehicles of something else. And I think as I got older, you know, live more life, you know, develop more issues, I think I lost the ability to understand what it means to be creative. And like you said, thinking, oh, why don't I do this? Why don't I do that? Oh, yeah, you know, it's like the problem is that thinking is sometimes the antithesis of just flow state, you know, outright creativity. You know, when you like, obviously you write a lot, Jack, you know, when you just pick up the notepad, it just comes out. Are you having a good day?
That's part of why it's been so important for me to share this work and why I talk about meeting your spirit, because we are body, mind, soul, and spirit. And you say that, you know, you tell your students that it's in their head, but where did it come from to be in their head, in terms of particularly if it's an original creation? And the more we can connect with and surrender, as you did when you had nothing to lose, is that essence of that connection where the information's being fed to you through your mind, from your spirit, from the ether, and then it's your responsibility for your body and your soul. And your body is the part that's got to pick up the pen or type it out or create it or, you know, start playing. And then your soul is bringing interpretation to it. But what happens, because you were talking about fear, say when we're a child and you see a little two-year-old, or let's say there's a kid of just over a year and it's starting to walk, and it walks and it falls, and it gets up and goes again, and it walks and it falls. And on the third or fourth time, or maybe on the first time, it cries, but it doesn't cry every time. And when it does cry, it doesn't stop it from going again. It might fall over, cry, it picks itself up, forgotten about the tears and the pain. But as we get older and our mind and body and soul start to lock into old stories, as you said, when you're younger. So the older and older we get, we start to bring up the old pain experiences of when we, you know, like when you gave up as a young musician, and the fear around that, and what if the love doesn't come back? And I think maybe when you went back, you said that your partner was, what's his name again?
James.
On the board, James. James was, you know, you said he almost pushed you into it. It wasn't until you pitched up authentically. Because you said no, you said no, you said no. And it's probably your ego hooking into the old stories. And then when you said yes, you thought you were saying yes, but you were saying yes from what I would call a lower level of self. Somewhere I've justified it in my mind. And my soul saying, oh, I can overcome it. But that's the ego where it actually likes to mess with us. I call it very sneaky. And it actually doesn't give you anything that resonates with you. And in that moment of I've got nothing to lose, you know, let's maybe walk away from this. In that moment of surrendering is when there's almost the clutter goes away. What's happening in your mind and your soul, and the spirit always speaks first through the body. So it brings forward movement, and you just had that momentum and it came out. So it's almost like you're getting the ego out of the mind and the soul, and you just, it came out. It was just there. It just happened.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Finding Love in the Chaos of Life.
If you have any questions about today's discussion, or would like to come on the show to share your questions or success stories, contact us on Instagram or Facebook.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to help spread the Dare to Be Love message, leave us a review or share with a friend.
Take the first step towards finding inner peace by meeting your spirit. To find out more, visit jackieburnett.com.
See you soon! Hi, Jackie and Tana here. This podcast is intended to inspire, support, and educate you as you journey through the chaos of life towards inner peace.
We do not offer any professional health or medical advice, as we are not healthcare practitioners. If you are suffering from a clinical condition, mental or physical, please seek help from a certified health professional.
This podcast is a Sophie Blue Press production.